Now, more 1360 Live on WMOV. Here's Greg Gack.
And welcome back. Great to have you joining us this morning on 1360 Live on WMOV. Always appreciate your joining us. There's a lot of folks I meet around here throughout, this area of the country who are very much, shall we say, Civil War buffs. There's certainly a lot of Civil War history nearby, if not in our immediate area, and it's kind of an understandable thing. And when we think of the Civil War, there's a lot of things we think of. There's a lot of fascination that goes with it. I hate to say there's almost a romance with it, but I guess there is. But one thing you don't necessarily think of is high tech. Well, in many ways, the Civil War was, for its day, a very much a high-tech effort, and that is the source of a book that has just been published from National Geographic. It's entitled Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. It's been written by Thomas B. Allen and Roger McBride Allen, and Roger, kind enough to join us in this portion of the show. Good morning, Roger. How you doing?
Very well, thank you. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, and thanks so much for taking the time to be with us. You might explain, I know you and I talked a little bit, but how this book got started. I guess really the genesis is with your father, Thomas Allen, not you necessarily, right?
No, that's absolutely true. My father, Thomas B. Allen, has written a number of books for the National Geographic. A recent one was George Washington, Spymaster. And to make a long story short, they approached Dad and said, how about Abraham Lincoln, Spymaster? The problem was Abraham Lincoln wasn't a spymaster. Dad and I put our heads together to basically try and come up with an approach that would bring in most of what they had liked about the George Washington book, and we really discovered how much Lincoln had moved technology forward, how he had made use of it, how that intertwined with the way he ran the war and ran his presidency.
You know, there's a tendency to think that much in the way of technological advances, I guess we tend to think especially militarily so, but in many other areas, happens to come with wars. It coincides with wars. There's a spur to find new ways to do things. And I guess maybe we tend to think that's always the case, but in truth, it really wasn't until the Civil War.
And you could sort of make the case wasn't quite in the Civil War. One of the things we discovered is very interesting is that practically all of the technological advances that changed warfare dramatically was that were things that were invented during peacetime, since the last war. In the 20 years or so before the Civil War, the telegraph came into common use. The railroad became much more an important item. The rifle that was used during the Civil War, manufactured in large part there in Harper's Ferry in West Virginia, came into being. One of the things we also discovered is there were a lot of, for want of a better word, mad scientists, inventors of one sort or another, who came up with all sorts of remarkable devices. There was a steam-powered cannon. There was a sort of a precursor of napalm, all sorts of crazy gadgets that were going to change warfare. None of them were developed in time. These were things that were invented during the war. None of them were really developed in time or became mature in time to really be of any use. With the exception of ironclad ships, nothing that was invented during the war really had an effect on the outcome of the war.
Wow, fascinating. I guess maybe it's corollary to Hitler's rocket programs, right?
Well, I can see what you're saying about that. The von Braun and the men who built the V2, I just happened to be reading about this, in fact. They really got their start in the 1930s and even the 1920s, and was only, and even so, they were barely able to develop the weapon during wartime, even though they had about a 12-year head start.
Yeah.
In the same way, a lot of the things people thought were going to be war winners broke down on the battlefield. They couldn't be supplied. The soldiers didn't know how to use them. They didn't know what tactics were appropriate for them. They just weren't the game changers that people thought.
I guess the real genius, though, in this, in terms of Abraham Lincoln and what we label the high-tech war of the Civil War, is his ability to see the potential of various wonders of the age in terms of prosecuting the war, his willingness to make use of some of these things, even when, for example, his battlefield commanders weren't necessarily in favor of it.
I think that's very true. There was an incident we discussed in the war where there were Union troops who were basically besieged at Chattanooga, and no one could see a way to rescue them. The railroad guys were in the room. They said, look, we can get 30,000 men there in 5 days. And the idea that you could do that, that you could transport that many men that rapidly over that sort of distance, would have been inconceivable before the war. Lincoln's facetiously made a bet that men couldn't even be gotten to Washington in that time, but that probably just spurred them on, and the soldiers did indeed get there and break the siege. And that simply could not have happened before the Civil War.
Wow. And there were other, I guess, wonderful little side stories. I mean, for example, you guys discuss a bit the use of balloons, and there was tremendous potential in that, but it was never properly used or accepted, especially by the field commanders.
That's absolutely true, and I think there are a few reasons for that. They were put to use, and they did see good service in the earlier part of the war. One of the problems was one of the promoters of them was George McClellan, who had an unfortunate habit of not winning battles. And so all the innovations and newfangled ways of doing things associated with him tend to fall into disrepute.
Ultimately, it is about wins and losses, isn't it?
Absolutely. The other thing is that the balloonists, the guys who went up in the balloons, in large part, had before the war been showmen. They were larger-than-life characters. They were doing stunts and trying to set records and do remarkable things in the balloon. They were flamboyant characters. They just didn't really fit into a military situation very well.
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to take them serious, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The great big gaudy pretty thing on the middle of the battlefield, with also every one on the Confederate side trying to shoot it down.
Yeah, which was impossible to do.
Yes, surprisingly, there were some close calls, but no balloon was ever shot down during the Civil War.
Yeah, in fact, you guys have even a little spot, I guess, sub-story in there about the science of it and why they couldn't shoot them down.
Right.
Yeah, the bullets just weren't going to get there.
Basically. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Without getting into ballistics on radio, when you aim up, the bullet will come down. But where it comes down is the tricky part.
That's often the case, yes. The other thing I really found rather fascinating was, and I guess, you know, one of the things a lot of us do not know about the Civil War, we know Lincoln was the president. We know, the Emancipation Proclamation, and we know he changed commanders a lot and that sort of thing. But, you know, I guess day-to-day basis, we don't know a whole lot, or at least most of us don't know a whole lot, about what Lincoln was actually doing as president. And one of the things that comes out in the book is that the man was very much hands-on.
Absolutely. He ran a lot of the war from the telegraph office. He would get up in the morning and leave the White House, walk across the way to the War Office. The building is still there. It's used for other purposes now. And sit down there and read the telegraphs that had come in, send off queries to his commanders, monitor the situation from there, directly order his commanders in the field and tell them what to do. He was in that telegraph office practically every day of the war.
Well, and he also showed up in, simply put, some rather dangerous locations to check on things, too.
Absolutely, yeah. There was one incident, there was a raid on Washington, which was in 1864, which actually took place about a mile from where I'm talking to you from. There was a place just outside Washington, D.C., on the border, called Fort Stevens. The Confederates had circled around and were coming in from the north and were trying to throw a scare into Washington and draw forces away from the Union attacks on their forces. Lincoln wanted to go see what was going on. And there's a wonderful story that's probably not all the way true about a young man by the name of Oliver Wendell Holmes, who saw the president there, and the man next to the president got shot while he was standing there watching the battle, and Holmes supposedly, but probably not really, yelled, "Get down, you I'll leave the word out, fool.
Yeah, and of course, Oliver Wendell Holmes went on to some rather famous things later in his own life. That wouldn't be a good way to start your career.
Well, it would have been a worse way for Lincoln to end his.
Well, that's true. That's true. That's true. Yeah, his history, yeah, had other things intended, I guess, didn't they? You know, it's one of the other stories, and you guys go into it in great depth, is the, you know, the ironclads. You mentioned them briefly. The Monitor and the Virginia. I guess maybe because I was raised in a northern state, I always remembered it as the Monitor and the Merrimack. Well, the Merrimack was the original name of what became the Virginia, right?
Yes, absolutely. And there's no one is ever going to settle that. And what is even more maddening is that the ship Merrimack was named after either the town or the river Merrimack, which are in New Hampshire.
Right.
Unfortunately, the river and the town are spelled differently. One has a K, the other doesn't. And throughout in all the years, whether or not you spell Merrimack with a K has been endlessly argued and will never be resolved. But then the Merrimack was basically deliberately destroyed by Union forces when Confederate sympathizers took over what is now the Newport News shipyard. The Confederates managed to raise the Merrimack and rebuild her and cover her with very thick iron armor, and she became the Virginia. And her job was to break the blockade, was to go out and destroy the Union fleet that was basically the cork of the bottle keeping the Confederate forces or Confederate merchant fleet from trading with the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
And they came within perhaps a few hours of doing that. The Virginia destroyed at least two major U.S. Navy ships and went home for the night and came out the next morning. During the night, the Monitor had arrived on the scene. And if she had been delayed more than a few hours, history could have been very, very different.
Absolutely. And basically, the two, in essence, fought to a draw, and for all practical purposes, that was the end of their careers.
Yes, but I argue different ways, and my argument would be that a tie goes to the Union in this case because the Virginia was unable to break the blockade. Because the blockade held, the Confederates couldn't trade with the outside world, and because of that, they were not recognized. They didn't get supplies in. If the Monitor had sunk the Merrimack, the result would have been the same. Or rather, if the Monitor had sunk the Virginia, the result would be the same. If the Virginia had sunk the Monitor, history would have been very different.
Yeah, indeed. Now, I'm kind of curious. I mean, you know, after that incident, with the Monitor and the Merrimack, basically they both kind of semi-retired to the sidelines, but they had to show some potential. I wonder why it was never exploited.
Oh, it was. It was. It was simply that this gets into a very complicated question. Because the Union Navy was blockading the South, you had to build a ship pretty much where it was going to be stationed. So if you're going to have an ironclad in Mobile out of Alabama, you more or less had to build it in or near Mobile. If you're going to have one in another port, you had to build it near that port simply because the Union Navy wouldn't let it get out. The early ironclads were terrible on the ocean. The Monitor was going on to another duty station, and she was being towed, and she sank. Shortly thereafter their battle, the Union forces were moving toward Richmond, and the Virginia was blown up by Confederate forces to prevent her capture. But the Confederates did build, and the Union, too, both built many more ironclad ships. They were the first, but they were by no means the last.
I see. Well, of course, it was a struggle, though, for the South to build ironclads. I mean, even in building the Virginia, they had to scramble just to find the materials.
Yes, and that was, perhaps, in some ways, the easiest one. There's a story we weren't able to go into as much detail in the book just for length purposes, but there was another ship, the CSS Neuse, which was on the Neuse River, and they spent 2 or 3 years building it. They were the Confederates, and they ran into all sorts of supply troubles, and they were cut off, and they couldn't get the materials, and there was a delay, and they sailed it a couple hundred yards, it got stuck, they had to spend months rebuilding it. And tremendous amount of effort, tremendous expenditure of limited resources to build this ship. Her first day in battle, I believe she fired one shot, and then she had to be scuttled.
Oh, wow.
So all of that time, effort, energy, expenditure, heart, soul, at the bottom of the river.
Wow, amazing. The book is entitled Mr. Lincoln's High-Tech War. Roger McBride Allen joining us. He's the co-author along with his father, Thomas B. Allen. And a little more with Roger coming up right after this timeout.